So now being out in the UK, are you finding that a lot of what you work through, kind of in those earlier years, post high school, post Portland, are you finding that resurfacing in terms of like being grounded contextually in London, the United Kingdom? Are you finding that you're having to deal with that, or that it's just morphing in different ways?
Yeah, well, as I was saying to you, man, people racist out here, boys.
Call it.
People are racist out here. So, no, absolutely. It's there. It's that question. Absolutely. I think very recently I had to interrogate the framework, the mental framework that I was using when thinking about this space. For my first year, I was almost hell-bent on finding everything I could wrong, that was wrong with the space. And then I would pick out things that, were might have fallen into a gray area or might be judgment calls. And I would willingly classify them as wrong as a means of further justifying this narrative that I have built up in my head. This place is backwards, this place is behind, this place is racist, this place and maybe all those things are still true, right? But it also doesn't mean that there's not something I can get out of this space, without having to torture myself in order to get it. So one thing I've really been trying to do this year is to push myself to not only acknowledge but latch on to the positive things I find out here, whether it be how, thriving this particular community in London is, or how international this place is in a way that you don't see really in any other major American city, with the exception of maybe New York. But even New York, the history of immigration, it's more longstanding. Here, a lot of the black and brown communities came over in the post-colonial era. So that means that there's still a richness and a freshness to those cultures that might have dissipated a bit in certain communities in America. Yeah, and I think that means that there's a whole lot here that I have to learn, not only about this place and the people that call it home, but about myself and the ways in which I relate to certain aspects of my heritage, my ancestral history, and yeah, my understanding of what makes me me.
Speaking of ancestral history, it's so funny that you touched on that topic because it just came to mind. But middle of November 2019, to be in London and to be among the privilege of even traveling, one, but like with the richness of our stories, what does it mean, to the people that came before us and now? What do you think that means?
That's a tough question because there's a part of me that wants to say that means everything. There's also a big part of me, probably a stronger part of me, that says that means absolutely nothing, right? And I think they're both obvious in different ways. The former, that means everything, is obvious in the sense that, of course, we've had the privilege of being able to step into spaces that people who came before us were denied access to, were killed for trying to infiltrate, and that is a source of pride, right? In certain ways, in certain ways. But it's also something that, at the end of the day, is really minuscule when we think about the grand scheme of life. I would hope that if I were to speak with my ancestors, the people that came before me, the thing they would want most for me is for me to be fulfilled in and of myself, for me to be content as a human being, to recognize the full scope of my humanity, to love myself, and to push love out into the world, right? And I don't need any of these spaces. I don't need any of this access in order to be able to do that. That's something that's possible irrespective of where you're at or how much privilege you carry. And that point is exemplified by the lives that they lived and the circumstances that they had to live those lives in, right? So yeah, it means everything and it means nothing.
And in thinking about that, what then do you have to say? Again, 2019, fulfillment is often derived from places that aren't authentic, right? And also we live in an era I call mindless tribalism, where a person can't hold two same thoughts without either being an enemy, even a person of your own community. How do you go about finding fulfillment? And I think more broadly, what do you say about how a lot of people derive their fulfillment?
We've mistaken validation for fulfillment in many senses, affirmation for fulfillment. And I think on a personal level, that's something I've tried to actualize in the work that I've been doing. That's actually very much the reason why I pivoted to music. When I got out to the UK, I worked in politics for a year and a half after graduating from Yale. I worked for my congressman. That whole world was so draining. It was this thing I had been taught to want. Yeah, you go to Yale, first thing they tell you at the induction ceremony, the president of the university will come talk to you. You sitting in the same seats that this many presidents are sitting in, this many Supreme Court justices, Secretary of State, head of this country, head of that country, billionaire, CEO of a Fortune 500 company, and you can be those people too. You are those people of the future. Travis. And you sit there and you're like, word?
Yeah. Oh, really?
Word? Yeah. I don't think those people looked like me, sounded like me, came from the places I came from. But it does, part of that idea does stick, right? Mm-hmm. A really good friend of mine, his name's Dustin Vesey. He grew up in a back and forth between a trailer park in Phoenix, Arizona. Mm-hmm. And he grew up broke. He got to Yale, and our senior year, we were driving to pick up a friend from the airport. Dawn, the sun had just peeked over the horizon, and he had this really solemn, kind of melancholy look on his face. I asked him what was going on. He's like, you know, some days I wish I had never seen all this. I was like, what you mean? He's like, you know, back growing up in Phoenix, in my community, all I thought was necessary to live a happy life was, you know, having a roof over my head, food on the table, a family that loves me, and friends that take care of me and support me and that I enjoy being around. That was it. That's all I wanted. I came here and I was taught to want all these other things, right? And I can't now unsee those things. So no matter how hard I try to shake those things out of my head, there's still gonna be that lingering thought, you know, if you don't become President of the United States, Secretary of State, you know what I mean? Ambassador to the United Nations, you've failed in some sense. You've wasted an opportunity. So I think to your question, I had really internalized a lot of that during my time at Yale. And that carried me through my first year and a half back home working in politics. I was like, okay, this is something I gotta do, right? This is something I have a talent for. I have to do this, not only for myself, but for my community. I had spun it into this whole warped thing where I was justifying this thing through being like, oh, but the people need it. The people don't need that shit. It was really me and my ambition and the seed of ambition that had kind of been planted in my mind that had begun to fester. So I left my job. My same friend, Carla, the one I looked up the Rhodes Scholarship with.
Yeah, shout her out.
She was back home and she was working in a restaurant. I hit her up like, yo, I need a job. She was like, yo, come bust this at this restaurant. Cool. So I worked in that restaurant for 5-6 months. Just as a busboy, and I stopped reading the news. I detached from everything. And my goal was to jump out the hamster wheel, in a sense, to jump all the way off that hamster wheel. I didn't want to go into the nonprofit space. I didn't want to go into anything political, into anything corporate, because I noticed very similar trends in all of them. A lot of well-intentioned people masking their own ambition in the sheepskin of the common good. I was like, I want no part of that anymore, right? But at the same time, it's such a fucking ironic thing to say because I had just won the Rhodes Scholarship. I knew where I was going, right? I had the privilege of being like, all right, I can spend 5 months doing this, but I know where I'm going next year. And I know I'm not going to be stuck here no more. That's a fear I had my whole childhood, is being stuck in my city, being stuck in my neighborhood. I knew I wasn't stuck no more, right? When I got out here to the UK, I made one promise to myself. I was like, every day you're going to wake up and allow yourself to do whatever you feel most compelled to do without questioning it. Without questioning it. If you feel like you want to do it, do it. And when I got out here, first thing I felt like doing every morning was making beats. On my computer, I swear, I was like, yo, I just want to make a beat. So I was like, cool, I'm just going to learn how to make beats.
Get to these beats.
No lie. And I just woke up and produced beats. And then one day I was like, yo, I want to rap over that. And I was like, nah, bro, come on. I was like, nah, but you promised yourself. Okay, go ahead. I rapped over it. She was trash. I said it to a couple of my friends. I was like, yo, what are y'all thinking of
this? Nah,
this
ain't it. This
ain't nah, some people, they actually, this is how I know I have good friends in my life.
Good,
they're like,
good.
They're like, yo, this is,
It's cool. Actually, no lie, if you work at this, I think you could actually be good at this. I was like, word? They're like, yeah. So they actually were incredibly encouraging. And of good. Course, there were a couple friends who were like, nigga, if you don't.
You, a basketball player that yelled to a rapper. Now you want to be a rapper, huh?
You're bugging. Yo, what is wrong with this man?
Right.
So, but I was like, okay, cool. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it, right? And I keep feeling compelled to do it. I'm going to allow myself to. I'm going to commit to it. And every day I kept waking up and feeling excited. I was feeling just as excited as mm-hmm. the day before, if not more so, about the prospect of making music, producing music, rapping, singing, all that. So I just threw myself into mm-hmm. it. I threw myself into it because I saw that as the only way that I would be able to finally break with that hamster wheel for good.
Right.
Yeah.
And it sounds like much of this is a mechanism to, one, protect your freedom.
Yeah. Right?
Because, I mean, I can see to myself and in a couple of my friends, colleagues, not so much, but
yeah.
that at a point you can get across the mountaintop or kind of peek over that proverbial mountaintop, whether yeah. it be through accolades or through just kind of a personal sense of being able to just let go.
Yeah.
How do you go about protecting that freedom in a space where you've come from kind of this imposed idea of Black excellence or just excellence generally mm. in society that also imposes that, but two, to kind of see the other side of it, right? To peek over that personal proverbial mountaintop.
There's a dude, he's like a big brother of mine. His name's Casey Gerald.
Mm-hmm.
He went to Yale. He founded the Black Men's Union there. And he came back every year and he would, you know Casey, yeah? He would speak to the Black Men's Union at the annual induction ceremony. So I met him my freshman year. And when I met him, he was very much in the same place I'm describing, just having come out of, right? Even in terms of the things that he encouraged and us as people who looked up to him, right? So I came up to him after the induction speech. I introduced myself. He's like, what do you want to be? What do you want to do? I was like, I want to be an ambassador to the United Nations or something. I want to be a diplomat. He's like, an ambassador, why not just run the whole thing? You should be Secretary General. And I was like, yeah.
That's an idea.
I never thought in those terms, right? Because quite contrary to this notion of Black excellence, we come from places where even that notion doesn't really exist right. in the same way it does in spaces like Cho or Yale, right? Or Oxford.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people, they just don't have access to what we would define as quote unquote excellence.
Right.
Right. So they have to make do in other ways. But once I was exposed to what like this notion of excellence was in those spaces, and somebody was like, oh, you could do that. I was like, oh yeah, I can do that. But Casey has a line. The reason I brought him up, he has a line in his book, There Will Be No Miracles Here, where, you know, he spends his whole life up until maybe 25, 26, thinking that, you know, the greatest revenge for the circumstances he had to grow up in and all the bullshit he had to be put through and all the racism he's experienced, the greatest revenge is success.
Yep.
And it's only through a whole lot of bullshit and losing one of the people closest to him that he realizes what he says in the book, which is, I realized that the greatest revenge was liberation. Greatest revenge was freedom. I try to remind myself that of where I come from. I try to remind myself of what I've done to myself in order to try to navigate these spaces that I didn't come from and gained access to. And then I remind myself lastly of how precious it is to have been lucky enough to realize what I was doing and how harmful that was to myself, to my personhood. Yeah, and I think I center that promise to myself.
Part 3, Sunday, July 12th.